Hello, you electronic cats and kittens. Sorry, I just couldn't resist. Welcome, everyone, to this here Electronic Engineering Podcast brought to you by EEJournal.com, hosted by me, Amelia Dalton, and absolutely no tigers were harmed during this episode. So there's that. All right, this week, we've got some drone dodgeball. We've got chassis and system management. And our most recent episode of Michael and the Bees. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm really ready for the children of the world to go back to school. Or at least just mine. And that made me think of all the different parts of school, you know? The parts of school that I would miss as a kid, or the parts that I would absolutely not miss. So, today's news you may have missed is brought to you by the bane of my childhood existence, dodgeball. Now, as a kid, I would have definitely been labeled as clumsy. And yes, if you're wondering, that has definitely continued into adulthood. I broke my foot playing mini golf. I sprained my ankle standing still. Yes, it's possible. And I have stumbled over more painted lines than I would like to admit. But as a kid, I was that one who always got hit in the head by the ball, you know, in gym class or on the playground. Maybe you were that kid. I definitely was. And one of the games that I hated the most was dodgeball. But what if this much despised game of my youth could change the course of drone development? I might not hate it as much, maybe. So the key to dodgeball is obstacle avoidance, right? Like, avoid the ball hitting my head again. Well, obstacle avoidance has also been one of the challenges in drone technology as well. And until now, most commercial off-the-shelf drones just weren't fast enough to deal with avoiding things. But the University of Zurich is looking to change this. They have actually developed a new system that gives drones much faster reflexes so that they can play, yep, you guessed it, dodgeball. So, today, most avoidance systems take around 20 to 40 milliseconds to process information in their environment. That's fine for big old buildings coming your way, but for birds or fast-moving objects, 20 to 40 milliseconds just ain't gonna cut it. So a team at the University of Zurich have come up with a way to trim that avoidance time down to a mere 3.5 milliseconds. So how exactly? Well, the key is the camera, of course. You see, these quadcopters built by this team at the University of Zurich were equipped with what they refer to as event cameras. So these event cameras, instead of analyzing each and every pixel in a scene to see if something has moved or changed location, these cameras actually only respond when they sense a change in light density. So the pixels that don't sense movement stay in a silent mode, which speeds up reaction times and reduces processing load as well. So, just any event camera will work? Well, not so fast. Most event cameras actually aren't tuned properly for drones. So this team at the University of Zurich found that if they developed their own algorithms that not only kept on the lookout for those pixel events in their sight, but also corrected the drone's own movement in real time, that these algorithms could sense objects being hurled at them between 81 and 97% of the time. And when they were implemented onto the drones themselves, they were able to dodge objects a good 90% of the time, which is much better than I was in PE class. And this team also found that with the addition of their specialized algorithms, they could also help their drones move faster, up to 10 times faster. David Valanga, primary author of this study, puts it like this. He says, "Currently in all search and rescue applications where drones are involved, the human is actually in control. If we could have autonomous drones navigate as reliable as human pilots, we would then be able to use them for missions that fall beyond line of sight or beyond the reach of remote control." Very cool. So if you want even more information about this super cool dodgeball study, I've included a couple links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com. All right, it's time to bring in Ken Grubb and Michael Monroe from Elma Electronic. We're talking about what system management models buy you as an engineer, why system management is not a one-size-fits-all scenario, and why optical and RF through the backplane is going to revolutionize the industry. Oh yes, and there's some bees business in there too. Check it out. All right, my guest today is Ken Grubb from Elma Electronics. Thank you so much for joining me, Ken.
Amelia, it's a pleasure to be here again.
All right, so at this year's Embedded Tech Trends Conference, you gave a talk called Maintaining a Healthy System, How Updates to Chassis Management and System Management Ensure the Health of Your System. So Ken, let's break those down into those two pieces. First off, chassis management. Now, how exactly are we going to ensure the health of our system with updates to our chassis?
So this topic is about a resource that examines the resources that are in the chassis. So for instance, a chassis typically has items to cool it and a power system for what we call V262 power supplies today. And then within the system, we also have a set of boards. So some of the boards within a SOSA architecture would include a single board computer, potentially, say a compute intensive or an IO intensive single board computer, and then a number of payload modules. Mm-hmm. We'd also have a switch, if you would, that's a central switch that connects everything together so the boards can communicate. So when you look at the role of the chassis manager has a capability to communicate over something called the IPMB bus that's within the chassis. So this utility bus is the connections between the items in the chassis, in this case, the plug-in cards, and also the resources in the chassis, which include the power supply, fans, and other potential sensors, say something like temperature. So the chassis manager's role in that is to interrogate the devices in the chassis and to get status, if you will, from them. And one can also look at it from the beginning, like the chicken before the egg, what you do. So when the chassis first comes up, you might want to say to the power supplies, hey, are you guys okay? Are you up? And you can pass messages back and forth between the power supplies to the chassis manager now. Prior, this capability didn't exist. Yeah. So now the power supplies, as I think today Bellman had given a pitch about that and talked about how the power supplies are becoming smart and they'll have the capability to report information back up to the chassis manager. Yeah. So this is a good place to start because if the power supplies aren't happy, then nothing else in the system is happy. Right. Something else you might want to check is if it's too hot. So if you have resources that you can look at relative to temperature, that would tell you that you're okay relative to the temperature. Let's say as you go on, the other things you might want to do is numerate, as sometimes it's called, the payload cards to see if they booted and if they're up and then if they're healthy, because they'll be able to report their status. So each one of them can pass back a record to the chassis manager. Once that data is collected, it could be locally processed or it is more likely going to be passed up to a system management entity that's going to make some decision on it. So how that happens is maybe TBD yet, but the chassis manager will have some capability to do initial processing of results, and then ultimately some of that information will be passed up to the next higher level to system management. So that's a sort of a brief overview of what might take place.
Okay, so let's talk about that system management part of the equation. What are you seeing there?
So system management, if you look at the set of standards that are being used within SOSA, SOSA is a collection in essence where if there's a capability that had already existed and it met the needs of the architecture, or let's say in this case the hardware architecture, then the SOSA process has been picking up those standards where they're useful. If you look at this over time, if you consider telecommunications, looked at that as a shelf manager. So you would have inside the system, you would have an IPMC, and then you would have maybe a chassis management controller. At some place, you would have next higher entity, a shelf manager. Eventually, you get to an outside entity that is the control or the level that is going to manage the information that's being obtained from the system and process that. So in SOSA, there are other models for that system management entity that are out in the public domain and have been in industry and used for years. What's happening now is, because this is not a simple one-size-fits-all scenario, it's being vetted within the SOSA subcommittees that are developing this. And as time goes on, the solution will be, let's say, vetted relative to use case, what's required, and that design, if you will be created within the SOSA working groups. So at this point, I think there are considerations such as, what do you do with security? What do you do with the information that you're getting, and how is it actionable? Do you want to keep it at one level? Do you want to share it out to another level? There's a lot of things that have to be considered. And what needs to be done is sometimes I think it's called the ConOps, where they have to decide what the use cases are going to be and then what the design really needs to do. That's still something that's been worked, but at this point, it's something that needs a little bit more innovation within whatever time there is for Snapshot 3, which I'm sure there's a pretty big push on fleshing that out. And as this goes to release 1, I'm fairly sure that the powers that be will want to see that sorted out.
Right.
So I don't think I can say much more about it today.
I also have Michael Monroe from ILMA. Thank you so much for joining me, Michael.
Hi, Amelia. It's good to be here. Tech Trends.
That's right. So a big theme at this year's Tech Trends is optical connectors through the backplane. Now, there are a couple VITA standards that are specific to this arena, VITA 67.3 and 66.5. They're all about RF and optical connectors in this realm. So tell me, Michael, what are these VITA standards looking to help solve?
So I think actually the development of the 66 and 67 standards are probably two of the major innovations that VPX has brought to the industry, because previously we had cables coming off the front of chassis for RF and optical. You know, they become an ergometric issue. You've got to move them out of the way. If you're going to remove a card, you know, they get more motion. When we move it all to the back of the backplane, they're in a much more protected environment, and it means we can pull boards out. Back in, I guess, 2012, they released 67.2, which was an RF, a full-size RF. And then in 2016, they released the 67.1, which was a half-size RF module. Well, these were developed when VPX still was focused on remaining appropriate for 8/10 pitch boards. But with SOSA really and the VPX development backplanes moving all to 1-inch pitch, they wanted to take up available space, and that gave us some room for more connectors. And so the 67.3, at that point, we wanted to have a number of different standard apertures that people could design to. And the standard really only tells you the outer envelope of the modules that will go in and where the, you know, the origin points are mechanically for dimensioning and the fasteners for attaching it. But everything within that is really can be customizable, because where people want the connectors within that 1-inch space depends on, you know, mezzanines and what they're being launched off. So that 67.3 was to do RF connectors, starting out with SMPM style connectors, which are much larger. Recently, there have been proposals for SMPS and Nano RF, which is a TE product, which are about twice the density. They're half the size of the SMPM. Even in the CMOS chassis that we did initially, we had combined optical and in a full-size module, 1 MT ferrule and 4 SMPM RF modules. Well, that really wasn't even within the definition of 67.3, but it really led to the 66.5, which considered the combination of both RF and optical modules. And one reason they really took some thought is because you need to locate them. So you have to decide an origin point for the optical MT ferrules, and they both have to center themselves as they engage. Anyway, I think that the addition of this RF and optical through the backplane is going to be one of the most revolutionary developments thus far for VPX. And it was really, it's being now implemented by SOSA.
Okay, so Michael, it's time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, you've been on my show a couple times, and we've talked about the saga of your beekeeping escapades. Now, you say you have an update to this story, so I guess this is episode 3 of Michael and the Bees. Tell me more about this.
Yes. Yeah, so when I moved into a plus 55 community in March of 2016, one of the sad things was that I wasn't allowed to have bees on my property. Well, I left my frames, and I might have mentioned this the last time, my equipment out on the driveway so people would see it. And the first thing happened, I got a call from management group, said, you've got bees on in your driveway, and you can't have that. And I said, it's empty hardware. Somebody said they saw bees. I said, well, you didn't. But I put that away, and then they came to me about a year later and asked if I could set up, because we have a green space behind that it's a registered wildlife habitat just behind our house at 19 acres. And the Greenway Committee came and asked if I would install one of my bees there. And I said yes. And so then they went to the builder, and the builder said, no way in hell, while we're still selling houses. Well, as of November, the HOA has been turned over to the community. So I am hoping come spring, I will have permission to put a beehive out into the Greenway.
Excellent. And I hope you do, because bees are awesome. Well, Michael, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're very welcome. They're always fun to talk about bees and connectors.
Hey, one last thing before we go. Maybe you haven't heard, but Chalk Talks have gone mobile. Now, in the past, me or one of my producers would travel to your location, set up in a conference room of your choice, and record your presentation. It worked beautifully. But today, we're bringing Chalk Talk to you. So if you're thinking that now is a great time to launch your very own episode of Chalk Talk, I've included an email link below the player on this week's Fish Fry-In page on EE Journal, and we'll send you a personal email all about the next steps toward your Chalk Talk greatness, or something like that. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, check out AmeliaD1978. And if LinkedIn is more your thing, well, sure, I understand. You can follow me on LinkedIn as well. Also, we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including that very popular Chalk Talk webcast series I spoke of earlier. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Fry-In page, you can check out the Fish Fry archive or subscribe to Fish Fry via Spotify, the iTunes Store, or Podbean. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Fry-In page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, even if your company makes it, that's totally fine. Shoot me a line at Amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of April 17th, 2020, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.